pressure. Won't give up. We'll always fight oppression. But we just need one night off to apply that good pressure.
You're tuned in to Typically Tuesdays on CJSF 90.1 FM for the campus community radio station on top of Burnaby Mountain at Simon Fraser University, where we are broadcasting on the unceded territories of the Squamish, Musqueam, Tsleil-Waututh, Stolo, and Kuku'lum First Nations. This episode of Typically Tuesdays was produced on the unceded territories of the Katsi, Kuku'lum, and Stolo First Nations, colonially known as Port Kuku'lum. Typically Tuesday streams online at cjsf.ca. Find our archived episodes on that website. You can also follow CJSF online on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, YouTube, and Instagram by looking up CJSF Radio. And don't forget to follow Typically Tuesdays on Instagram. We are at Typically Tuesdays. My name is Leslie, and you're tuned in to part two of Typically Tuesday's deep dive into Soviet Wave, a subgenre of EDM and relative to synthwave that's specifically produced to evoke a sense of yearning for the Soviet era. It makes heavy use of synthesizers, darker, dreamier melodies, and often uses audio clips from Soviet-era films, political speeches, radio programming, and cartoons. In part one, Jade and I chatted about how the West perceives the Soviet Union and that legacy. We also chatted about the term post-Soviet and some of our questions around it. If you want to hear about that, you can check out part one of our conversation, which is up now on cjsf.ca. It's filed under Typically Tuesdays for May 17th, 2021. When we left off last, Jade and I were going to listen to some Soviet Wave tracks and dive into a discussion on why the subgenre became popular in the West. So here's our first song for today. This is Melancholy by Human Tetris. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Typically Tuesdays. You just heard A Sea of Comet by Vesna Vesna. And before that, again, Human Tetris with Melancholy. My name is Jade.
I'm Leslie. Today we are talking about Soviet Wave. And if you don't know what it is, you should keep tuning in and look it up, because it's a fascinating subgenre of music that has become popular among a lot of young people on the internet all over the place, not only in ex-Soviet countries, but also especially in the West, but also because it is an interesting phenomenon, which involves another interesting phenomenon, such as nostalgia. Before we went on our music break, Jade was talking about the ways in which the West has peeked into and developed an interest in Soviet Wave. So let's talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah, so I did a bit of research. I read a lot of think pieces on Western listeners of Soviet Wave. And one of the reasons that people give to explain the rise of popularity in this kind of music is like escapism. So you're listening to this music that's full of nostalgia, which also comes with like this equal sense of optimism and a little bit of melancholy, because your own daily life is like all doom and gloom and full of despair. Whether or not that's actually true, or if that's your self-assessment, it doesn't really matter. The point is that you don't feel really great about like your life right now, and you don't feel great about the future, so you're listening to the kind of music in the West. So this idea of immersing yourself in the past. We're in another reality to escape the overwhelming present and the future full of anxiety. So if you obsessively watch Studio Ghibli movies, congrats, you do this. lately, I mean, personally speaking, I've been fixated on like consuming media content that I watched growing up. Like I'm pretty much through all 29 and counting seasons of Detective Conan. And I've been listening like basically only to indie music that I listened to when I was 14. So I definitely do this. And another phenomenon that's kind of like an escapism too that is really popular is like cottagecore. Because that's like a thing that TikTok teens do. And there's a lot associated with cottagecore, but not gonna unpack that suitcase. It's not even my suitcase. Why am I in a hotel? So I think that is one explanation, but I think we can go a little bit deeper about this particular subgenre of music. So when I was researching for this episode, I read an article that makes a really good point. Well, not really a point. It's like just pointing out a fact. It's not even an opinion, which is that most people who did not live through Soviet times in Soviet countries and otherwise not have, you know, deep rooted connections to the former Soviet Union, whether that's like your family or it's somewhere you like lived in and worked in, which is really the majority of Westerners and especially the majority of North Americans, really can't begin to understand the Soviet Union in like a personal intrinsic way. The Soviet experience is not one that many people outside of it are privy to, especially young people. So why is Soviet Wave so popular amongst that demographic? I would actually say that it's exactly because people can't relate on an intrinsic level. So to begin with, because of the Cold War, the messaging you have about the Soviet Union and communism in general is always pretty limited. The content of the messaging, of course, obviously depends on what side you were on, but generally speaking, you're not getting a very nuanced picture of, say, Soviet life. And for young Westerners, say people born in the 90s and later, there wasn't even a Soviet Union to remember, period, right? And chances are, if you don't have family in the former Soviet Union, it's really not something you have a personal connection to. So that brings us to the present. If you're a person disenchanted with your life and you're kind of a history buff, and communism and the Soviet Union is kind of like a touchy or taboo topic where you are, which is America in a lot of cases. And you're curious about Soviet history and the Soviet Union, what do you have to work with? So what you have to work with are basically the remaining tangible cultural relics of it. So movies produced in the time, literature produced in the time, lots and lots of music, lots of documentary films and videos, photographs, encyclopedias, propaganda posters, an insane amount of architecture, and lots of monuments. And in recent years, there's been a surge of interest in Soviet culture, and no doubt in some part bolstered by social media. So on Instagram alone, there's an account at Soviet Visuals, which posts really digestible pieces of visual history from the Soviet Union. And it has nearly 250,000 followers. And they also have a Twitter account, and I think they might even have more on Twitter. And their non-Soviet, former Soviet followers are kind of like a mix of history buffs, artists, and also socialists, even some politicians and like public figures. I know that, what's his face? Mia Farrow's son, Ronan Farrow. I think he follows it on Twitter, which is really funny to me. So another account that I actually follow that I'm familiar with is at Socialist Modernism. And I think it's run by an architect or a historian, and a catalog.
It catalogizes.
It catalogs brutalist and modernist architectural heritage across the Eastern Bloc, the Soviet Union, and beyond. And there's, in the architecture world, there's like myriad. There's like thousands of accounts dedicated to doing stuff like this, but I think this is probably the biggest one. They have like a 500,000 followers and several published books. So all of this to say, the aestheticization of Soviet history is very present, especially in the digital age. And I mean, I'm not going to label this as romanticization, because not everybody that does this has a romantic or positive mental image. In fact, a lot of people have a very negative one. But that being said, aesthetics can evoke strong emotions. And when you have nothing but aesthetics to go on, it's easy to project your feelings onto something. So I think that's really why this kind of music is so popular within the West, within young people, because they don't have that personal connection. So it's kind of like tabula rasa, it's a blank slate. They have all this like visual history to go on. They have all this visual history to go upon, but none of like the affective or like interpersonal history. So they can just like say whatever. This is like why you get these comments that are like, oh my God, I wish I was like there to see Yuri Gagarin, you know, go into space. I wanna be there to like hand him a flower and stuff like that from like 14-year-olds.
Yeah. So, yeah. I think that's really interesting, because this discussion about nostalgia reminds me of like the, I guess it's kind of like the etymology of nostalgia. And its very first usage in like the 1600s, it meant like a longing for home. So it was like a physical ailment.
Right.
And throughout time, it has become more of this like psychological thing, where it is much more about emotions. And now with, I guess with a lot of media and creative work, using nostalgia, the mood as a mode of I guess inspiration or aesthetics, that kind of changes. So in her paper, What We Talk About When We Talk About Media and Nostalgia by Ekaterina Kalinina, she specifically distinguishes using Grange's concept of the two types of nostalgia. You have the emotional kind, nostalgia mood, and then you have the kind that is purely aesthetic and is used for commodification, which is nostalgia mode. It sounds like a lot of the fascination with the Western fascination with Soviet aesthetics is a kind of blurry mishmash of both, where it is, as you said, it's probably mostly based on aesthetics, and those aesthetics are sometimes commodified. At the same time, it has to bring in that emotional factor, right? That deep kind of undescribable, bittersweet longing of a place and time in which you did not even experience. But it's not so much about that reality. It is more about like the feeling. It's like when drag queens say, "I'm feeling the fantasy."
Right. Yeah. Exactly. No, I definitely agree with you. And I think something that complicates this whole thing too is sort of like, if you do like a more historical analysis of neoliberalism and globalization, how these things alongside technological advances really complicated this idea of time and space. So again, going back to the etymology of nostalgia, where it's tied to a very specific time in a particular place, I think nowadays it's getting more and more muddled. Our attachments to things kind of like almost transcend time and space, where like in a way that feels like really like strange and magical and almost metaphysical. And I think you're right to say that it really is. It's very, very hard to quantify these things. And it really, really is just a very strong feeling. Maybe that's all we have. Maybe that's all we have are feelings.
Too deep. Who knows? Too deep. Too deep. We're get out.
I actually want to talk a little bit more about feelings, but let's play some
Let's
more.
Let's do music.
Let's feel some music first. So coming up is Motorama with Far Away from the City. Enjoy.
This is Bird Note. In higher animals, the brain is like a Lamborghini. Amazing engineering, but expensive to run. In a human, the brain uses about 10 times more energy than any other organ. A bird's system is exquisitely attuned to this expense. And among several carefully studied species like the black-capped chickadee, a very smart adaptation has evolved. You can usually hear the black-capped chickadees call throughout fall and winter, but they aren't singing much. They don't need to. So in their brains, the centers that control how they learn and give voice to songs shrink. But as spring nears and the birds resume singing in earnest, these control centers in the brain rejuvenate. This same seasonal fluctuation appears true of the chickadee's hearing ability. Experiments have shown that a bird's hearing is more acute in spring. So is their ability to interpret sounds. This may help male birds tell the difference between a neighboring male he already knows and an interloper who's infringing on his territory. And more finely attuned hearing can also help a female bird rate the songs of males she hears so she can pick out the best partner. All of which means that seasonal changes in the gray matter itself put birds' brains in a class by themselves. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann.
Welcome back to Typically Tuesdays. You just heard 8080 by Pirolda. I'm Jade.
I'm Leslie. Talking about Soviet Wave today. How do you explain Soviet Wave? I feel like because it's such like an info-packed episode, I feel like I need to like kind of explain it every single time we come back.
My opinion is that if you're just tuning into this, you might as well just wait until we upload the episode and just watch that on CJSF instead. There's been a lot of talking today.
Yeah.
And we're going to do more talking.
Yeah. Very information heavy episode. Take out your notebooks and your pens and take notes. Let's continue to talk about Soviet Wave. So when we left off, we were talking about kind of the feel of nostalgia and the feel for Soviet Wave.
Yeah, I think it's incredibly affective. It's effectively affective, as one says, as I say. So a lot of the aesthetics around Soviet Wave revolve around, say, space age engineering. It's not just all of Soviet history. It's a lot of it is like incredibly tied to Soviet technological advances. So a lot of it is space age engineering and the sense of Soviet futurism and the utopianism alongside obviously the politics that drove the space race. And maybe I'm romanticizing this a bit, but when I kind of started digging into this and, you know, sort of looking at how people are reacting to it, I think people that are like discovering and listening to Soviet Wave kind of mirror the content of Soviet Wave. So it's music that's based on a sense of discovery and curiosity and excitement, and it's being discovered by people who are equally as curious and excited. I think a lot of people, like, when it comes down to it, they're just drawn to the sense of discovery, including myself. It's just, you know, it's very exciting stuff that's designed in some way to make you feel very emotional. It's to make you feel like a very particular set of emotions, which is kind of, maybe this is a bit of a reach, but for me, when I think about that, just going down straight to feelings, it's the same kind of feeling among certain populations or groups when, say, I don't know, when Reddit brought down the stock exchange for a week or something like that, where, you know, that time way back when we thought Bernie was going to win the primaries, like the sense of like communitas, even, you know, if you know nothing about stocks or politics, and even if you like don't care about Bernie, it's like, it makes you feel the sense that something monumental is happening. And I think Soviet Wave music is really evoking the same kind of sense of the same sense of feeling.
Yeah, I think you make a really good point there. And some of the stuff that I read that was about specifically about, sorry for the problematic usage, post-Soviet nostalgia. Scholars drew the distinction between like a reflexive nostalgia and a restorative nostalgia. A reflexive nostalgia is one that is more emotional and, you know, is about like a time of childhood and can be characterized best by like maybe the saying like a return to the countryside, right? Like, as you said before, going, you know, it's summer vacation, going to grandma and grandpa's place for a month and hanging out, you know, running across fields of beautiful grass and such. And then the other one is a restorative nostalgia that has more political implications to it. The thing that I think was interesting when people drew this kind of distinction is that a lot of people, when they were talking about the rise in like in the commodification of nostalgia or like nostalgia things in the ex-Soviet bloc countries, was that a lot of people were interested at looking at it and interested in consuming that kind of stuff because it gave them that feeling of when there was less alienation amongst people in your communities, you know, neighbors like talk to each other more, or like there was like a strong sense of like knowing oneself because you knew that other people were kind of like in the same boat as you.
Right.
Does that make sense? I don't know. That was a thought, I guess. Like I wonder if people who are producing this music are producing it with that, with wanting to evoke that feeling.
Yeah, it's interesting. Everything you said reminded me of this song I really like by Daniel Kahn called The Good Old Bad Old Days. And it kind of talks about sort of the very ambivalent feelings you have towards a past that wasn't always so great, but you had fun nevertheless. So I'm going to just like recite a few verses. Mm. So this is particularly, he's an American musician who's living, who resides in Berlin. So this is about East and West Berlin. Now I'm working for euros and drinking alone where we used to spend marks at the bar, and the weeds have grown over the border of stone that cuts through the town like a surgical scar. And so many streets on this faded old map are like names written over a grave. And it all makes me so mad because it wasn't that bad in the good old battle days.
Deep.
Yeah.
Cutthroat.
Mm-hmm. But yeah.
I think the part that you mentioned about the communitas is like really fascinating because it's like I keep getting reminded of that thing that you said earlier, which was like, was it the New International?
Mm-hmm.
Was it that? Yeah. No thoughts. Here's new music from a pretty popular Soviet wave artist. This is Proton 4 with Flying in a Dream.
Thank you. This is Bird Note. For most albatross species, raising a chick is a real challenge. Waved albatrosses produce such slow-growing, needy offspring that females lay only a single egg every 2 years, and both parents need to share the load until youngsters can hunt on their own. Albatrosses tend to pair for life, and it can take a while to find the right partner. So some species don't start breeding until they're 10 years old, with some individuals even waiting till they're 20. Reunited pairs go through an elaborate, synchronized ritual of braying, wing spreading, and bill tapping to reaffirm their bonds before getting down to the business of breeding. In Hawaii, biologists were puzzled to find that some Laysan albatross pairs had not one, but two eggs. Then they found that some of the birds going so faithfully through the ritualized series of courtship displays were both female. Although the eggs were fertilized by males that had since died or were from other pairs, the females were bonded to each other. Many of these female couples remain together for years. They can't successfully raise both offspring, but their combined efforts are necessary to raise one chick. For Bird Note, I'm Wenfei Tong.
Welcome back to Typically Tuesdays on CJSF 90.1 FM. You just heard On the Wings of a Dream by Proton 4. My name is Leslie, and you are tuned in to part 2 of Typically Tuesdays deep dive into Soviet Wave. If you missed part 1, you can check it out on cjsf.ca. Look for Typically Tuesdays and find it under the May 17th program. One of the things that I've learned from doing the research on Soviet Wave is that if we're going to be talking, if that people are going to be kind of distinguishing nostalgia, as many scholars have done, distinguishing nostalgia that is emotional or solely political, I think what I've understood of Soviet Wave to be is like, it's a very like sociocultural thing. It's fascinating to think how the imagery is not meant to be uniting people for a political purpose or a political front. Mind you, of course, like, you know, you do have like some leftist people getting into this music, right? But I would assume not the majority of people. Yeah. And so it's interesting to me that like people have to draw that distinction, like the producers of this music have to draw that distinction, right? Like, I'm not thinking about the government, I'm thinking about the communities that were formed and the bonds that common folk shared during that time, or like that's what I'm trying to evoke, right? You know, maybe they're also thinking like, I'm not sorry that the bloc collapsed, but I'm sorry that those securities that we had and the dreams that people built never flourished. And you know, I'm not longing for the nation. Again, I'm like thinking about grandma's house, you know, I'm longing for the countryside.
Yeah.
Part of the thing I think about critiquing nostalgia in creative work and in media, at least one thing that I've noticed is this very, I think oftentimes like a little bit naive argument that aesthetics is purely commodifiable, or like nostalgia is purely commodity, and that we are kind of like in a stage in capitalism where very few things are left, I guess, like kind of like untouched by profit or gaining profit, or no, what is it called? Not venture capitalism. What is it called? Pursuit of profit, I guess. For me, I understand where that argument is coming from, but I think sometimes it does need a little bit of work if we're going to think about how nostalgia is commodified, because it is, you know, very emotional. But at the same time, I think it's also important to think about how, as we've explored in this hour, how certain communities are built, how certain bonds are built, and also how stories are told. It's not pure at all, but I wonder if this sort of consumption of post-Soviet nostalgia in the West is going to start to fuel like more critical thoughts about the West, right? People, yeah. It's going to like prompt people to actually become a lot more interested in that history and in those cultures, and to think about either society or culture or art or politics in a way that isn't just solely based on entertainment and aesthetics, but one that is also actually kind of critical.
Right. Yeah, I think you make a really good point. I think nostalgia is incredibly powerful. I think nostalgia can be very much unifying. And I also think nostalgia can be an incredibly dangerous thing. Mm-hmm. When you're fixated on a mythical point in the past, historically has, it's always led to bad things happening in the present. So I would caution against doing too much of that. I think if you're really interested in this music and you're interested in, say, the primary samples, the primary sources that people sample from, look at them. You know, go beyond aesthetics. Don't look at it just because you think it looks pretty. I think it has more value than that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because, like, the thing that I'm starting to be to wonder is, you know, that that social media, the social media accounts that are archiving these aesthetics, for them, maybe at some point, this is just all about the look, maybe even about the clout of gaining like hundreds of thousands of followers who kind of become enamored with the way that these photos look, the way that this time and place can be imagined and kind of romanticized and glorified. But there also has to be, I think, people who are learning about that time period for themselves, maybe getting and maybe starting to become more in touch with like their own roots, like people in the diaspora, or I mean, even like a scholar who's like, I'm interested in understanding more about this period in time, you know, and I need primary sources, but it's not always easy for me to access them where I am for whatever reason. So the social media account is my prime source or something like that, right? Yeah, I don't know. That's kind of my thought, which is,
yeah.
Go ahead.
I think divorcing politics from aesthetics is not a good thing. And I think maybe some of these accounts really thrive on divorcing the politics from aesthetics. So you can have these, you know, visuals of Soviet life, and you don't need to think about really Soviet life in and of itself. It's sort of, when you're looking at the past feels hermetically sealed off and you only see it through photographs. That's an incredible, it's a very different experience from someone who have lived through the times and is living through a history of the present.
We are hitting the top of the hour on Typically Tuesdays today. Thank you so much for tuning in. You know, we can't do the show without your support. We can't do the show without you tuning in. As a campus community radio program, we need your presence in order to be a thing, to exist. So thank you for being present. If you want to support the show beyond just tuning in, there are a few ways you can do that. You can follow us online. We're on Instagram at Typically Tuesdays. Come engage with us. Do you want to propose like a question for this episode that like people can possibly engage with us about?
What are your thoughts on the Soviet Union? I don't know.
I would like to know also if you know anybody who makes Soviet wave music or who is very attuned to Soviet wave communities, please get in touch with us. Most of what we have been looking at for this episode did not necessarily come from any of those musicians or anybody in those communities. It's not necessarily niche. A lot of the people who are in those communities who like talk about Soviet wave in kind of this magazine style way, we couldn't find those sources in English. So if you know somebody who is a part of those communities who makes that kind of music, or who has like a good ear on what's happening in those communities, let us know. We'd like to. Maybe you can hook us up. You can be the middle person in that venture. Anyways, also tell people about our show. That's how you can keep supporting us. We're going to close off with one song, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. My name is Leslie.
And I'm Jade.
What is the name of this last song?
And here is Run by Artek Electronica and Friends.
Прошу, беги, лай, 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 лай.